The camera was pointing directly at the crowd that was racing away from the explosion and directly toward where Callahan stood with her phone. The video was of medium-grade resolution, but even when the shot was marred by shaking or jostling, the image of the skeletal remains of the museum, the whooping sounds of sirens as ambulances and fire engines screamed up to the pier, the distant image of a survivor being pulled from the wreckage, brought the full horror of this scene into courtroom 2A. Sounds from the gallery competed with the audio. Cries were heard. An elderly man moaned loudly, then rushed from his seat and ran toward the exit. A woman followed him out. Yuki asked for the lights to be turned up, and when the doors were again closed, she thanked the witness. A clearly angry Connor Grant stood and approached her. He greeted her and then said, "Ms. Callahan, can you connect me in any way to that explosion?"
"You were standing on the sidewalk."
"And you? Where were you standing?"
"Behind you."
"And were you connected to the explosion?" The witness stared at Grant until he said, "I guess that's a no."
The witness was dismissed, and as she left the courtroom, Yuki thought about Grant's astonishing skill in disabling witnesses without implicating himself.
Judge Hoffman said, "Will the prosecution call their next witness?"
Parisi stood, saying,
"The people rest."
The judge turned his eyes to the defense table and said,
"Mr. Grant, are you ready to present your case?"
Grant said,
"Your Honor, I'd like to add a witness to my list, Ms. Anna Lee Shaw."
Len Parisi got to his feet and said,
"Approach, Your Honor."
The judge beckoned to counsel on both sides, and when the four were in front of him, Parisi said,
"This is very late for the defense to be coming up with a new witness."
Grant said,
"Your Honor, I only became aware of this person's name yesterday, and it took our investigator until now to locate her. She can speak to my whereabouts and frame of mind before the bombing."
Parisi said urgently,
"This is completely out of bounds. We haven't deposed the witness, Judge. We must have time to do that before she can testify."
Hoffman said,
"Mr. Grant, make this witness available to the prosecution immediately. Mr. Parisi, take the rest of the day and all of tomorrow to check her out. We'll resume the proceedings on Thursday."
The judge adjourned the court, leaving Yuki to wonder about the open switch of this new witness. What the hell was Connor Grant pulling now? Chapter 41. Julie and I were sitting together on a lounge chair beside the indoor pool at Pacifica Rehab Center, where Joe had been living since his release from the hospital. The pool room was large, with many floor-to-ceiling windows, a huge aqua-blue pool with ropes separating the lanes, and a lifeguard perched in a tall chair mid-pool. Families grouped around small tables, and a half-dozen swimmers did laps to the soft music coming through the speakers. Julie Pie was wearing a candy-striped tutu of a bathing suit, her dark hair in two little pigtails above her ears. I wore jeans and a white cotton blouse over my two-piece, not sure if I would swim or watch Julie and her daddy from the sidelines. Julie shrieked. I looked up and saw Joe rolling toward us in his chair, the scars showing vividly on his scalp and arm, his right leg still encased in a walking boot. I had been afraid of Julie's reaction to seeing Joe this way, but I'd worried for nothing. She screamed again, this time,
"It's Daddy!"
And she ran across the tiles in her bare feet and into his open arms. She climbed onto Joe's lap and he hugged her to him and rolled over to my chaise. I got up and gave Joe a gentle hug.
"So glad to see my girls,"
he said, his voice breaking with emotion. Julie didn't notice. She was singing out,
"Let's go! Let's go in!"
Joe said,
"Next time, sweetheart."
"No!"
I watched and listened as Joe explained to our two-year-old that he still needed help getting in and out of the pool, but that he was getting better really fast. He asked me,
"Lindsay, you brought a suit?"
I did. I stood up and wriggled out of my jeans. I tried not to make a big production out of it, but I knew Joe was watching me undress. It had been 8 months since we'd lived together, made love, had breakfast with the baby, been a family. I turned away while unbuttoning my blouse,
flashing on our last delicious romp before Joe went off the radar without warning, without sending even a text message. His voicemail box had been full. His car had been gone. No one had seen him. Those lost days were agonizing. I'd thought he was dead. By the time Joe resurfaced 2 weeks later, it was because our cases were entwined. Of course, I hadn't known he even had a case. He offered an explanation, but not much of an apology. He expected me to understand that his secret assignment from the CIA was a duty and a sacrifice, and that when he said country first, it didn't mean that I was second in his heart. But his actions told the truth. He had put me second, and there had been no hiding from myself what I'd started to piece together about a mysterious blonde, a double life in his past, and the real possibility of more of the same in the future. So for my own protection, I'd kicked Joe out and armor-plated my heart. Who could blame me? Now I walked over to the curved tile steps and into the pool, and once I was seated there in the shallow end, I reached for Julie. My little girl, who looks so much like her father, toddled over to me and wrapped her arms around my neck. I held her and danced with her and helped her swim with the noodle and the boogie board while Joe cheered from his chair. Once I was sufficiently wrinkled and cold, I took Julie and my bag to the dressing room to shower and dress. When we reemerged, our dear and precious child broke away from me and ran to Joe. "Hey, Jules," I said, sitting down on the chaise. "Shall we have dinner with Daddy before we go home?" Joe said,
"Sorry, but I can't, Lindsay. I've got PT in a couple of minutes."
"Rain check?"
"Sure."
I tucked in my blouse, tied my shoelaces. Joe said my name and caught my eye. He said,
"I'm going to make everything right, Lindsay. I mean it."
I nodded. Could he do that? Was it possible?
"Mommy, let's go, okay?"
I kissed Joe on the cheek and said, "Take care." I saw the question on his face as I picked up Julie and headed for the door. I understood the question, but I didn't know the answer. I settled Julie into the car seat and back and saw a folded piece of paper on the floor. I knew it was the list of the dead and injured that Brady had handed me after Citron. I opened it up and read the list. I found Joe's name on the injured list. And then I saw another name that I'd either not read 2 months ago or not remembered. Sophie Fields was on the list of fatalities of the tragedy at Citron. Sophie Fields had died. Chapter 42. It was Thursday morning, the second day of Connor Grant's trial, and Yuki was very ready for it to begin. The jurors were in their box. The judge was at the bench in conversation with his clerk. The gallery was full and the doors were closed. The court officers had formed a line blocking the door, and two others flanked the bench, guns on hips, eyes scanning the room. Cameras rolled from the corners of the ceiling. Yuki and Len had deposed the late-breaking witness, Ms. Shaw, the day before. Apparently, this recently added witness was Grant's idea, and in Yuki's opinion, he was taking an unnecessary risk. But Antonelli looked relaxed. No doubt she was glad enough to shift the burden of the outcome to her former client. Win or lose, there would be plenty of media exposure for Antonelli. Judge Hoffman spoke.
"Is the defense ready, Mr. Grant?"
Yuki glanced at the defense table and saw that Grant and Antonelli were conferring behind their hands. Grant stood up.
"The defense calls Anna Lee Shaw."
A court officer opened the door, and a young woman entered. She wore a slim leather skirt, a tight-knit top, and high heels, and her glossy auburn hair fell loose to the middle of her back. Ms. Shaw took the stand, and after she'd been sworn in, Mr. Grant began his direct exam.
"Ms. Shaw, what is your occupation?"
"I'm a graduate student, going for my doctorate in literature."
"Have you met me before?"
"Yes," Grant asked.
"Were we together the evening of August 3rd between 6 p.m. and 7:30?
Parisi said,
"Objection. Leading the witness, Your Honor."
Overruled.
"I'm going to allow it."
Grant repeated his question, and the witness said,
That is correct.
Why do you remember the exact time?
Because, Ms. Shaw said quietly, you hired me for an hour and a half, starting at 6.
The judge asked Shaw to speak up, and after she repeated her answer, Grant asked his next question.
We spent this time together in the Hotel Slocum on Battery Street, a few minutes' walk from Citron. Is that correct?
Yes.
Was I carrying a bag of any kind?
No, nothing.
How did I seem to you? Grant asked.
When we were together?
Let me be more specific. During the time we spent together, did I have an attitude that would suggest to you that I was going to blow up Citron? Was I nervous or agitated?
Parisi rose ponderously to his feet.
Objection! Mr. Grant is asking the witness to speculate.
The judge sustained the objection, and Grant said,
I asked for her interpretation of my behavior, but I'll rephrase. Ms. Shaw, did I tell you anything that would lead you to believe that I had plans to blow something up?
No.
Thank you. I have no other questions.
Parisi got up, scraping his chair legs loudly against the floor, and approached the witness.
Ms. Shaw, how do you know Mr. Grant?
A friend gave him my name.
I see. For what purpose?
Shaw said.
It was transactional. I needed to buy books. Connor gave me $500.
I see. Do you have any knowledge of the defendant's whereabouts before he met you at the hotel at 6 o'clock?
No. I only met him the one time.
So he could have rigged bombs to blow up prior to your assignation?
Said Parisi. Grant stood up and yelled,
Objection!
Yuki knew the judge would sustain the objection, and he did. Connor Grant was impressive. Parisi said,
Thank you, Ms. Shaw. That's all.
The witness stood up, and Parisi, who had started back to the prosecution table, wheeled around.
I'm sorry. I have one other question. You're still under oath, Ms. Shaw.
The witness sat back down.
Ms. Shaw, you have testified that Mr. Grant paid you for your time. Did Mr. Grant also pay you for your testimony today?
The witness recoiled. Then she said,
He only told me to tell the truth.
Thanks, Ms. Shaw. No more questions.
Chapter 43. Grant looked quite at ease when he called his next witness.
The defense calls Lieutenant Jackson Brady.
Yuki was well aware that Brady was on the defense witness list, which was pretty outrageous and another of Connor Grant's risky moves. Still, it was a little shocking to see her husband come through the doors and walk to the witness stand. After swearing to tell the truth, he took his seat in the box. Grant said,
Just a few questions, Lieutenant. You head up the homicide squad of the SFPD's Southern Station, is that correct?
Yes, it is.
You and your team were responsible for finding and arresting the person or persons who blew up Citron, right?
That's right.
Sergeant Boxer works for you, correct?
Yes.
And you two were the members of the police department who interrogated me the morning after the bombing?
Correct again.
Grant shot a look at the jury as if saying, Get this. He asked,
During that long interview, did I ever say or indicate that I had anything to do with the Citron disaster?
No, you did not.
But you investigated me anyway.
Of course, Brady said evenly. You were our primary suspect. You had told Sergeant Boxer that the bombing was your work.
So she says. As a result of whatever she thought she heard, you went to my house, my place of business, spoke to my neighbors, my banker, my dry cleaner. The list is long.
Yuki could see the muscle in Brady's cheek twitch.
She thought, Please, sweetie, don't let him get to you.
Brady said,
We spoke to anyone who might know your whereabouts before the bombing, and anyone who might have insight into your character. Lieutenant, did you find any direct evidence linking me to the bombing at Citron?
We found circumstantial evidence, Mr. Grant. Your presence at the incident,
your avid interest and expertise in explosives, your notes found in your laboratory. So, to be sure we all understand, the answer is no. You found no physical evidence at the site of the bomb, no DNA, no fingerprints, and there were no witnesses who could connect me to the bombing, isn't that correct? Most homicide cases are built on circumstantial evidence. Please answer the question, Lieutenant. Did you find any direct evidence connecting me to the bombing, yes or no?
No, said Brady.
But we have plenty of reason. Your answer is no. You have found no direct evidence. Right, Lieutenant Brady?
Right.
Yuki reminded herself to breathe. Brady was doing fine, walking a narrow line between answering the question and underscoring the truth. Grant pressed on.
Lieutenant, did you have any other suspects?
No.
None at all? No one who had a grudge of some kind? Maybe a terrorist group? Gar, for instance.
The video purporting to be from Gar was a frat boy prank. So no.
So you concluded that even lacking physical evidence against me, I was the person who perpetrated this horrible tragedy?
Brady just stared at Grant.
Answer the question, Lieutenant. Lacking physical evidence against me, did you have no other suspects but me, yes or no?
You admitted to the bombing before you claimed ignorance, said Brady.
Grant shouted, Your Honor!
The judge asked the witness to answer the question.
Brady said,
We had no other suspects.
Grant put his hands in his jacket pockets, looked down, and seemed to be gathering himself for his next charge.
You've stated that I was your only suspect. Isn't that right, Lieutenant Brady? And still you charged me and are part of a conspiracy of law enforcement to tar and feather me on my way to the gallows.
Yuki stood, saying,
Objection, Your Honor. Mr. Grant is argumentative. Move to strike Mr. Grant's remarks.
Judge Hoffman said,
Sustained.
He ordered the statement to be stricken from the record and instructed the jury to disregard Mr. Grant's characterization of the proceedings.
Don't do that again, Mr. Grant.
Grant said,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't realize that was against the rules.
The judge said,
Move on, Mr. Grant. Do you have any other questions for your witness?
Yes, I do.
Grant asked,
Lieutenant Brady, are you related to anyone involved in this trial?
Brady shifted in his seat. Yuki felt her heart contract and then resume beating with a hard, rapid patter. A dense silence pervaded the courtroom as everyone listened for Brady's answer. Brady said,
ADA Castellano is my wife.
I see, said Grant.
He pivoted to look at the jury. A sunbeam came through the windows at just that moment, lighting his face. He went on,
So let me see if I've got this right. You're in charge of this one suspect case, and your wife is prosecuting me. Is that collusion or something? I'm not sure of the term.
It's nothing, said Brady.
My wife and I are professionals. We have never discussed this case together.
That's what you'd like us to believe, but
I think otherwise. We have the sergeant's husband, Mr. Molinari, backing up my so-called confession, and now...
Parisi was on his feet, yelling,
Objection!
And Grant shouted over him,
You and your wife are nailing me to the cross! What would you call that, Lieutenant? Conspiracy? Railroading?
I call it bullshit, said Brady.
The judge banged his gavel and admonished counsel, and instructed the jury to disregard. He then told the gallery to quiet down immediately or people would be removed from the courtroom. Yuki was watching Connor Grant. For the first time, she saw rage cross his face, and he was transformed from the mild high school teacher to something twisted and monstrous. Grant shouted at Brady,
One suspect! No evidence!
Judge Hoffman slammed down his gavel and shouted back at Grant,
Sit down, Mr. Grant! Speak out of turn again or cause any disruption at all, and you will be watching this trial on closed-circuit TV. Do you understand me?
Grant apologized to the court and said,
Judge, I ask that this be stricken from the record.
No, there's no reason to strike that, Mr. Grant.
Is the prosecution ready for cross?
Parisi stood.
Lieutenant Brady, have you colluded with ADA Castellano? No. We have a Chinese wall at our house and we respect it. Please tell the jury what a Chinese wall is. We don't discuss the case together. Ever. Period. Lieutenant, thank you,
said Parisi.
Now, here's a hypothetical question. If you were going to destroy evidence, DNA, fingerprints, video cameras, etc., would blowing up the crime scene with a hard force explosion accompanied by a flash fire do the job?
Absolutely.
There was nothing left of Citron but 6 tons of granulated rubble.
Parisi thanked Brady and told him that he could step down. Chapter 44. After the lunch break, as everyone resumed their places, Yuki took her seat at the prosecution table. Len sat down heavily beside her. Len seemed to have recovered his composure, but Yuki was still reeling from the accusation that she and her husband had colluded. The worst part of the assault on Brady's credibility was how Grant had brilliantly summarized his defense in 4 words. One suspect. No evidence. If Antonelli had coached him to do this, kudos to her. Antonelli sat quietly by as Grant introduced his character witnesses. His priest, his banker, and last, Kenneth Evan Miller, an 18-year-old student at St. Brendan who was president of the senior class. Kenneth Miller had close-cropped blonde hair and horn-rimmed glasses and wore a forest green blazer with the school logo on a patch over the breast pocket. Miller testified under Grant's questioning,
"You are a very devoted teacher. I'd say you have a warm relationship with your students, and I personally learned a lot from you."
Yuki was watching the young man closely. When she had deposed him, she'd felt that Kenneth Miller was holding something back. She was going to try to dislodge whatever that something was on cross. After Grant had finished eliciting praise from his former pupil, Yuki stood, straightened her suit jacket, and crossed the polished wooden floor to the witness. She said,
"Mr. Miller, did Mr. Grant use his own unpublished work on explosives as a course book?"
"Sure. We learned about all kinds of bombs, from firecrackers to nukes."
"Did Mr. Grant cover any other branches of science?"
"Yes, he covered the basics. Look, I like him. I think he's very smart. But I'm under oath, right? So I've got to say, I always thought he was obsessed with explosives."
Grant objected.
"Judge, can he just volunteer his opinion?"
Judge Hoffman said,
"You opened the door by asking his opinion of you, Mr. Grant. I want to remind you this is your witness. Go ahead, Miss Castellano."
"Mr. Miller, could you elaborate on what you mean by obsessed?"
The high school senior looked toward the science teacher and said,
"I'm sorry, Mr. Grant, but I gotta say it."
Then turning back to Yuki, Miller said,
"Mr. Grant is single-mindedly all about combustion, or, as he has often said, the beauty and the power of explosions, the sound and the light, the beginning of creation, and maybe the end of it, too. There were many times when I thought he was freaking crazy."
Yuki thanked the witness and crossed paths with Grant as she returned to her table. Grant didn't wait for her to sit down before he began his redirect examination of Kenneth Miller.
"Ken, when you say crazy, that's a figure of speech, isn't it?"
Miller said,
"I don't think so."
Grant said,
"Let me put it this way. You like girls, Kenny?"
The boy stiffened in his chair.
"Yeah, so? Are you obsessed with them?"
"Okay, maybe. Sometimes, yeah."
"Does that mean you're crazy or that you have a passionate interest?"
"Whatever you say, Mr. Grant."
"I'd say that while you might be girl crazy, you're not insane. Would you agree?"
Yuki called out her objection.
"Leading, Your Honor."
The judge said,
"Sustained."
Miller looked up at the judge, who said,
"Don't answer." "Nothing further,"
Grant snapped, adding under his breath, "Class dismissed."
Yuki didn't care what Grant said under his breath. Ken Miller had said that Grant was obsessed with explosives, and he'd detailed that obsession, including a reference to life and death. Nothing Grant could say would negate that. Yuki knew that she'd scored a big one for the team. Len whispered to her,
"Good play, Yuki."
It was good. But was it enough? Chapter 45. Yuki's happy moment faded fast as the science teacher, who looked and sounded as normal as every person in the courtroom, including the judge and jury, got to his feet, straightened his tie, and buttoned his dark blue jacket. Connor Grant said,
"Your Honor, I'm going to testify in my defense."
Hoffman said,
"I suggest you use your advisor to question you."
"Yes, Your Honor, that's our plan."
Grant was on his own witness list, so it was no surprise to Yuki and Len that he would testify. Len had loved, loved, loved the idea of having the opportunity to grill him on the stand. But what they hadn't known prior to the trial was that Grant was so sharp, so nimble. Maybe the right word for him was brilliant. Now Len told Yuki he wasn't sure he should cross-examine Grant at all. The defendant was not just slick, he was very compelling. Grant took the stand and the oath. He adjusted his glasses, ran his hand over his face, and sipped some water as Antonelli approached. As Yuki expected, Antonelli asked Grant if it was okay to call him Connor, and the next question was to ask how he was feeling. Grant said it was okay, and he was feeling fine. Antonelli proceeded to ask brief questions regarding where Grant had been on the evening of August 3rd after leaving the Hotel Slocum. Grant said,
"I was walking north along the Embarcadero."
Antonelli asked, "What did you see?" Grant sketched in the moderate traffic, the perfect temperature, then jumped directly to
the thunderous explosion, the pink light on the flying hail of glass. "I was absorbed in the entirety of it. I was awestruck," said Grant. "This was the explosion of a lifetime."
And then Grant cut Antonelli off before she could ask another question. He explained earnestly that he had made an offhand remark to the tall, blonde-haired woman outside Citron, not knowing that she was a police officer until she had cuffed him. Yuki objected that the defendant was ranting beyond the scope of the question, which was, "What did you see?" Hoffman said,
"I'm going to let him run with this for another minute or so. Let's hear it in brief, Mr. Grant."
Grant thanked the judge and continued,
"I had been in a state of wonder. I was confused. I just didn't get why she was arresting me," Grant told the court. "Then I find out that she lied about what I'd said, and her husband backed her up. I guess that's what married people do. More to the point, I think the jury should see how easy it is for an innocent person to be tried for a crime when people in positions of authority collude."
Antonelli said, "Connor, you've written a book-length manuscript on bombs. When this enormous explosion occurred in front of your eyes, was that a coincidence?"
"Yes."
"Did you bomb Citron?"
"No, I did not."
Antonelli asked, "Did you know about it in advance?"
"Absolutely not."
"Do you know anything about that explosion that you can tell the jury?"
"CSI Director Clapper said that I could have built and set this bomb with my eyes closed. He's totally wrong. This was a very expert detonation. I couldn't have done it if there'd been a gun to my head."
Connor Grant turned to the jury. He looked utterly sincere.
"I feel very bad for the people who were killed and the families who were affected. I am also a victim. My name has been tarnished. I don't know if I have a job when this is over, or if I'm going to jail for something I didn't do."
As Yuki got to her feet, Antonelli cut off her objection. "Your Honor, we're done. The defense rests," said Antonelli. Judge Hoffman said,
"Cross, Mr. Parisi."
Chapter 46. Len Parisi stood up and, looking neither left nor right, walked across the floor and stopped a dozen feet from the witness box so that his voice would project and so that Connor Grant would have to speak loud and clear. Parisi said,
Mr. Grant, do you have a degree in chemistry? Yes or no? Yes. Do you know how to make bombs? Well, there are bombs and there are bombs. Yes or no, Mr. Grant, do you know how to make bombs?
Grant sighed.
Yes. Do you know how to make a compression bomb? It's not that hard. Yes or no, Mr. Grant? Yes. Do you have a laboratory at your home? Okay, small lab in my garage. We should take that as a yes? Yes. Do you have a Cytron membership? Yes. Yes, you have access to Cytron, a home lab, and explosive materials in that lab, and you know how to make a compression bomb, which is not that hard.
Antonelli stood, said, Objection, argumentative.
Sustained, said the judge.
Parisi kept on rolling.
Mr. Grant, were you standing within 100 yards of Cytron when it blew up? Yes. Yes. You were right there. I have no further questions for the witness.
Every eye in the courtroom was on Parisi as he turned his back on Grant and returned to his table. Judge Hoffman told the witness that he could stand down. Chapter 47. I was going through backlogged email at my desk in the squad room when Claire called. She said,
Want a splurge? I'm thinking noodles. Maybe fish.
Asian fusion on King?
Perfect.
It was the best idea in the world, and there was no one I'd rather have lunch with. We met at Claire's car, and she drove us to the noodle shop on King Street. There was a line outside the restaurant, but by the time we were standing inside, 2 seats had opened at the counter. We ordered tekkamaki and spicy sesame noodles, and after the sushi chef placed the seaweed-wrapped raw tuna in front of us, we got to talking. I told my BFF about taking Julie to see Joe, and she told me about her domestic concern. Claire's husband, Edmund, plays bass with the San Francisco Symphony. He told me he can't stand the hours anymore, and his arthritis is getting worse, said Claire. I think he'd really like to stay home, work on compositions of his own. Rosie would love to have her dad pick her up after school. He'll collect Social Security in a couple of years. He's not a terrible cook. So dinner would be waiting when you got home. Dinner, wine, living on less, but also a less grumpy husband. Still thinking about it. Sushi trays were removed and the very hot bowls of savory soup arrived. Between spoonfuls, Claire said,
I wanted to talk to you about something else, Lindsay. Uh-oh, I think I hear spooky suspense music.
Claire laughed.
Yeah, well, I've been out on the Medical Examiner's Spooky Music Network and found out something interesting.
I said, shoot, pouring more tea for the two of us, and Claire went on. The pathologist at Metro Hospital took in a fatal heart attack victim a month ago. She thought that the heart attack was suspicious. Same MO as the others?
Yes. Needle mark in the haunch. No lethal toxins in the blood. Heart wasn't pristine, but didn't look like cardiac arrest.
One distinct difference.
Well, don't stop now.
The victim was male, homeless, a drug addict. It's a miracle that the pathologist who found this needle prick thought something of it at the time. Made a note on the autopsy report. But no one claimed the body, so that needle mark wasn't investigated. However, there was a witness to the stabbing.
Really? There was a witness?
A do-gooding citizen, a landscaper. Had his earmuffs on and was trimming some shrubbery or something. Saw the victim go down, saw someone rush away. The landscaper had seen this homeless person earlier, given him a couple of bucks. You have contact info for me?
I know you're busy, Linz.
Not too busy. In fact, my last case had been a man who shot his wife, then dove off the Golden Gate Bridge before I could arrest him. After that, I'd kept my desk clear for the trial.
Good. Because I'd like to work this case with you.
Sure thing. Claire took out her phone, tapped on the keys.
Okay, said Claire.
I've sent you the name of the victim, contact info for the pathologist, and the landscaper.
Got it, I said.
I'm telling you, Claire went on, some stealthy needle sticker is out there somewhere with a drug that stops hearts and fades very quickly from the bloodstream. Lab tests haven't found the toxin. Can the landscaper ID the stealthy needle sticker?
You'll talk to him, said Claire. I can get you pictures of the body. He's already been interred by the city.
Nothing on missing persons, I take it? I asked, putting down my spoon.
Nothing that I found.
I need some green tea ice cream. How about you?
Red bean for me, I said.
I was already thinking about this possible crime spree. Anything that could take my mind off of Connor Grant's trial was a relief on the order of a blessing. Chapter 48. Parisi stood to make his closing argument. Yuki stared up at him, thinking that with his black suit and red hair, the splash of red tie, he looked like a volcano starting to blow. He walked toward the jury box and took a position near the rail. He said,
"Ladies and gentlemen, this has been a difficult case to hear, and deciding on this case is one of the most important things you'll ever be asked to do. Mr. Grant is a very clever man. He's not a lawyer, yet your front row witnesses to how skillfully he defended himself. He says he's not proficient enough to build the kind of bomb that destroyed Citron, and yet he has had years of studying and teaching about explosives, an obsession with bombs, all kinds, according to his own witness, Mr. Miller. Grant had all the materials a bomb maker could need. If he was missing something to make the bomb that could level Citron, whatever he needed could be found at a home improvement store for pocket change."
Yuki looked at the jury. They were rapt. Even Connor Grant couldn't take his eyes away from Leonard Parisi. Parisi went on.
"Mr. Grant would like you to believe that his presence in front of Pier 15 at the precise moment the bomb went off was a coincidence. It was not. Mr. Grant told Sergeant Boxer and her husband, a highly knowledgeable former law enforcement professional who has been with the FBI and was deputy director of the Department of Homeland Security, that he blew up the museum. He described the explosion as a thing of beauty and said that he was proud of his work." It's awful to hear that, isn't it? I call it diabolical.
Len let his words hang in the air for a moment. Then he walked along the jury box, hand on the railing, and he gave the jury his eye-to-eye attention. Parisi said,
"Mr. Grant had the means to build those bombs and the opportunity to plant them in the museum any time and detonate them remotely. Why did he stand on the sidewalk totally unafraid as the crowds fled for their lives? Because he made that bomb. He knew the extent of the bomb's power, and he wanted to witness his homemade Big Bang, his peak science project, and the culmination of his career as a teacher. It turns out to be an object lesson for Mr. Grant. Remaining at the scene to witness his work caused him to be ecstatic to the point that he didn't realize he was making a confession to a police officer until he was in the patrol car. 25 people died as the result of that science project," said District Attorney Len Parisi. "Don't let this man get away with murder."
The judge called on Connor Grant, who went out to the well and stood behind the lectern. Once again, Yuki thought what a natural he was. She could see how a career as a high school teacher hadn't stretched him to his full capacity. Blowing up Citron, then defending himself in a trial of so much interest to the world against 25 counts of second-degree murder? He was made for this.
"Members of the jury, as Mr. Parisi said, I'm not a lawyer," said Connor Grant. "So I'm talking to you as an accidental defendant, a person just like every one of you. You've heard the case against me. While I was still stunned by the force and the effects of the explosion, I supposedly admitted blowing up Citron. To be fair to Sergeant Boxer and Mr. Molinari, I think they misunderstood my astonishment
and took it to be pride of accomplishment. They were wrong. Homicide Lieutenant Brady told you that the police had only one suspect, me. Why didn't they keep looking when so many people had died and they had such nothing evidence? I'll tell you why. They needed a patsy. They needed to clean up the mess, and in a time when bombs are going off all over the world, they sought to calm the city down. So they nabbed me, and they piled on until they had some kind of case. It's what's called a rush to judgment.
Grant paused as if he had been seized by emotion. He cleared his throat, apologized, and picked up where he'd left off.
The prosecution's forensics expert testified that I could have built and set those bombs based on no evidence linking me to Citron. There was no evidence. No motive. Just hypotheticals. Can you believe that?
Yes.
Believe it. You heard it all right here. This case against me is entirely without merit. In fact, I am a victim of circumstance, and this entire case is based on supposition. There is not a witness nor a shred of tangible evidence tying me to this terrible crime. Here's the sum total of the prosecution's case. One suspect, no evidence. I'm asking you not to be swayed by the inflammatory rhetoric and the video of people screaming and the number of people who died in Citron. I didn't kill them. The judge will tell you that if you have reasonable doubt that I committed this terrible, regrettable crime, you must find me not guilty. Please, don't ask me to pay for someone else's crime.
Part 3. Chapter 49. A man with a slight build, thinning sandy blonde hair and short arms, who could have been in either his late 30s or his early 50s, depending on the light and the angle, stood over the body on the sidewalk. The deceased was a real estate broker who had been standing outside his office on Stockton having a smoke when a stranger with a sharp in his hand had come up behind him and jabbed him in the right buttock. The broker had turned, given the stranger a questioning look, and grabbed at his chest, making a strangled "wah" sound before dropping to his knees and falling face down on the pavement. The man with the blonde hair was Edward Lamborghini, as in the Italian racing car, and was known as Nettie Lambo. Nettie started to laugh when the broker dude fell, but cautioned himself to stay cool until he was actually dead. That might take another minute or so. Nettie looked around in all directions. No cars had stopped, no pedestrians had walked by, but there were people inside the office waiting for Mr. Holmes for sale to return. Sadly, Nettie had to go.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. I am free. And you? You're as good as dead. You've got nothing to worry about anymore. Have a good trip.
Nettie stuffed his weapon into a pocket of his khaki windbreaker and walked casually away from the dead man up to the corner of Stockton and Pine. He looked both ways, crossed at the green, and headed west toward home. The traffic on Pine was moving, and there were even a few pedestrians making the climb up Powell to the cross street. Nettie began to trot as if he were out for a run. His mind was full of endorphins or serotonin or some natural jet fuel created by his own special brain. As he ran, he exulted in his latest perfect crime. The exhilaration he felt was like flying a kite in a lightning storm. No, it was like being that kite. The risk, the danger, the freedom of flight. He had earned his flights. That's why he was not just free. He was untouchable. As for Mr. Holmes, Nettie silently thanked him again for providing this excellent flight of well-being. He ran down the hill of Mason Street, feeling the incomparable rush. Breathless, he turned the corner onto Bush Street, dashed in front of a couple who were taking their time, and made it to the other side before the light changed. He began walking at a regular pace. When he was a block from home, he stopped in front of the frame shop on the corner and looked through the windows. There was a tall, gold-framed mirror on an easel, and he could see himself and the traffic flowing behind him at the same time. When he was sure no one had followed him, Nettie made his move. Chapter 50. The twin brick towers of the Hyde Street Psychiatric Center, known to the clients as the Hyde and Seek Loony Bin, were vine-covered, connected by the one-story administrative block, and fronted by a spiked wrought iron fence. An alley ran along the dark side of the north tower, 10 feet wide by a block long, bounded by the blank concrete wall of the Walgreens next door, the corner of healthy and happy. Nettie slipped into the alley and went directly to the green metal fire door leading to the loony bin's garbage room. The metal door squealed when he opened it, but he was the only one around to hear it. Commercial garbage days were Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and this being Sunday, the overflow garbage was piled high in plastic bags, with a narrow path between them leading to the tunnel door. Nettie unlocked and cracked open the painted wooden door to the tunnel that ran between the loony bin and St. Vartan's Medical Center, the gigantic teaching hospital across the road. Right away, he heard the rattle of trolley wheels and saw the orderly pushing a food cart from the kitchen. Nettie popped inside the tunnel and closed the door behind him, hearing the solid click of the lock. Another food cart came toward him. The orderly called out, "Hey there, Nettie! How's our Nettie? Looking good, Nettie?" He answered in a practiced, high-pitched falsetto,
"Hey there, Mr. Larry! Nettie's good!"
He gave the orderly his bright young child look, then crossed the width of the fluorescent-lit tunnel and jogged up a flight of stairs to the top landing, which was the lower-level entrance to the North Tower. There was a keypad beside the doorframe as well as a doorbell. Nettie knew the code to the keypad, but that was his secret. He pressed the button. He waited a minute, and then the door swung open, and Dr. Hoover was there. Once, after Nettie first met Dr. Hoover, the doctor had given him a quizzical look and asked him,
"You're just fooling with me, aren't you, Edward?"
Nettie had said,
fooling with you.
He had grinned brightly like the brain-damaged, mentally challenged dolt he pretended to be. Hoover had said,
"I'll see you in our session tomorrow. Same time, okay, Edward?"
Nettie had said,
"Same time!"
Dr. Hoover was smart and wary, but that was okay for now. Hoover kept Nettie on his game. If Hoover ever got onto Nettie's act for real, he would have a surprise heart attack. What a shame. What a loss that would be. Now Hoover said,
"I was just looking for you, Edward."
"I went down for a snack,"
Nettie said, clapping his hands.
"I hear you, but it's time for dinner now."
As Nettie followed Dr. Hoover down the linoleum-floored corridor past the dispensary, he sneaked the empty vial and the used syringe out of his windbreaker pocket and dropped them into the needle disposal can outside the nurse's station. A second later, he ran, catching up to Dr. Hoover's long-legged stride, entering the common room and going from there to the noisy, joyful chow room that fronted on Bush Street. Nettie squealed hellos and waved various hand signals to other patients, cupped the cheeks of Billy the Kid, saying,
"Hiya, Billy! Billy good?"
He pushed Billy the Kid's wheelchair up to table 6 and took a seat at one end. Dinner servers came by with the trolley loaded with big vats of food, ladled out the green beans and the mash, slapped down a side of fish next to the veg. Another server came with the jugs of lemonade, pouring it into upheld plastic cups, orderlies watching on the sides, breaking up the fights. The hide-and-seek loony bin was a zoo, all right, populated with some of the most peculiar people in the city. Nettie knew how to fit right in. No one would ever suspect him. No one would ever find him here. They thought he was autistic. They thought he had fetal alcohol syndrome or that he'd been dropped on his head. They said he had a low IQ and couldn't live a productive life on the outside. But Nettie knew better. He had been getting away with perfect murders for years. That was genius. He held up his cup for lemonade, and when it was full to the brim, he sucked it all down. It was good to be Nettie Lambeau, and it was good to be home. Chapter 51. Yuki was on the phone with Brady when Len Parisi loomed huge in her office doorway.
"Jury's back," he said.
"I'll call you later,"
she said to her husband. For the last 2 weeks, sleeping in the same bed with Brady had been impossible. He was the kind of sleeper that could jump awake if the faucet was dripping in the bathroom down the hallway. And she couldn't sleep without flailing, punching pillows, making a cocoon for herself with the blankets, and talking in her sleep. So she'd slept on the couch, her mind poring over every word of the days of testimony and her interpretation of things said, not said, questions asked and answered or not asked at all. Brady had called this trial her comeback tour, and it felt that way to her. The Citron disaster was a big league crime that would never be forgotten, nor would the horrible, insane defendant, who was as clever as the very devil. And Yuki felt rusty after the year of pro bono small potatoes. Now Len was waiting for her, and within the next half hour they both would learn if the jury's decision was win, lose, or hung. Yuki locked up her handbag and followed Parisi out into the busy hallway, threading the maze of cubicles and taking the elevator down to the second floor. A sheriff opened the courtroom door for them, saying,
"Good luck."
Yuki smiled, said, "Thanks," and with Len headed up the center aisle, through the filled gallery toward the prosecution table. As heads turned to look at her, Yuki read the anxiety on the faces of the friends and families of the victims, all of whom had suffered the sudden loss of loved ones and were now hoping for swift punishment for Connor Grant. Yuki was right there with them. She and Len took their seats, noting that the defense table was unoccupied, which was reasonable. Grant's legal advisor, Elise Antonelli, had to bring a change of clothes for the defendant, wait for him to dress, then, along with two armed guards, escort him from the jail on the sixth floor, down the back stairs to the second floor, and through the side entrance to the courtroom. Was Grant sweating the verdict? Yuki hoped he was drowning in his sweat. She and Len had talked for days about what had gone right and what might have gone wrong in the people's case. Len, who rarely looked back, had questioned his decision to let Grant's statement, "one suspect, no evidence," stand, rather than repeat what they had already fully refuted. Now Len seemed to be having second thoughts. Yuki had been sure his instincts had been correct and had said so to Len. On the other freaking hand, reasonable doubt on the part of one juror could hang the jury. Len checked his watch, and just then Antonelli and Grant breezed into the blonde wood-paneled courtroom through the side door. Yuki noted that Grant had aged in the 2+ months he'd spent in jail. His skin was pale. He needed a haircut. His beard was unkempt, and the scar cutting through his top lip was obscured by the growth of his mustache. But despite his scruffy appearance, his clothes were clean and pressed, and his posture was good. He looked confident. Judge Philip R. Hoffman came through the door behind the bench. A low rumble of crosstalk moved like an oncoming storm from the back of the gallery forward, and was shut down hard by a few good bangs of the judge's gavel. Hoffman said to the bailiff,
"Bring in the jury."
Chapter 52. After 3 days of deliberation, the jurors entered the jury box. Yuki searched their faces for tells. Several of them, the car salesman Mr. Lewis, the software engineer Ms. Shannon, the elderly retired haberdasher Mr. Werner, avoided her gaze. Len said,
"Jesus,"
so softly no one heard him but Yuki. But that one barely audible word chilled the blood pumping at 120 beats per minute through her veins. When the main doors were closed and guarded, the bailiff announced that court was in session. The judge said,
"I've been told that the jury has a verdict."
The foreman, Dennis Lockley, stood. He was a chain store pharmacist, 42, married, and the father of 2 boys.
"We have, Your Honor."
Mr. Lockley passed a folded sheet of paper to the bailiff, who carried it to the bench. The room was utterly silent as Judge Hoffman unfolded the paper, read it, and turned it back over to the bailiff, who returned it to the jury foreman. The judge said,
"The defendant will rise."
Grant and Antonelli stood and faced the jury, and Hoffman asked Lockley to announce the verdict. Lockley read the name and number of the case, and then said,
"In the first count of murder in the second degree in the above entitled action, we find the defendant, Connor Grant, not guilty."
Connor Grant's face lit up with relief. His attorney clapped him on the back as a dissonance of gasps and shocked exclamations sparked in the gallery, caught fire, and exploded. The gavel banged repeatedly. The judge issued loud warnings. When the noise quieted at last, he asked the foreman to continue. Lockley read out 24 more not guilty verdicts in the deaths of the other victims. Yuki was frozen to the seat of her chair. She stared at the jury foreman, and when he sat down, she dimly heard the judge thank the jurors for their service and release Connor Grant from custody. But it wasn't over. A man in the gallery shouted the defendant's name, breaking Yuki's stunned paralysis. She turned to look at the man who'd shouted and saw him jump to his feet. He was in his early 40s, Yuki thought, 6 feet, husky build, his dark hair slicked down tight. He shouted at the former defendant, Connor Grant.
"You did it, you bastard. You killed my wife. I'm Master Sergeant Carrie Woodhouse. My dear wife was Lisa Woodhouse. Don't forget me. I'm the one who's going to make you pay."
Grant yelled back,
"You're crazy. I'm an innocent man. I've always been an innocent man. Maybe you set off that bomb."
The judge's voice boomed.
"Quiet. Court is adjourned. Bailiff, clear the courtroom."
Hoffman stood and disappeared through his private doorway, accompanied by the clamor of the crowd as they rushed for the exit. Yuki felt Len's hand encircle her biceps, and she stood up like an automaton. Her mind filled with cases that had gone against her.
"Yuki, this isn't on you. You did a fine job. We couldn't prove what we knew, that's all. Grant is a smart mother. And a damned lucky one."
Chapter 53. It was the day Connor Grant had been found not guilty. Those of us who'd watched it on the squad room TV, which hung from the ceiling, saw the infuriated mobs that sprang up spontaneously downstairs on Bryant. Reporters cornered men and women on the street and asked for their views on the not guilty verdict of Connor Grant, and were told that the DA was to blame because clearly Connor Grant had blown up Cytron. Not a smidgen of doubt could be found. An old chant was dusted off and repurposed. "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Len Parisi's got to go!" Cindy Thomas was one of the reporters on the street. She interviewed the jury foreman, Mr. Dennis Lockley, for the San Francisco Chronicle and as a stringer for NBC. Conklin and I were watching her when Brady came out of his office and pulled the side chair out from my desk and straddled it so he had a direct sight line on the monitor. On screen, Cindy was shouting her questions over the chaos of horns and chanting around her, and Lockley looked about as comfortable as a man standing in a puddle of gasoline surrounded by chain smokers. Cindy asked,
"How did the votes break down?"
Lockley said,
"It was unanimous for acquittal."
"No one thought he was guilty?"
Cindy asked incredulously. Lockley started to walk away.
"I didn't say that," he said.
"Mr. Lockley,"
Cindy said loudly as he started to cross the street.
"What are you saying? People thought he was guilty but couldn't vote that way?"
"Right,"
said Lockley over his shoulder while braking for the opposite side of the street. Jurors had the right to decline post-verdict interviews, and reporters shouldn't pursue them if they didn't want to talk. Still, reporters noticed Lockley making his getaway and followed him as Cindy summarized her interview for the camera.
"What I'm hearing, David, is that the jury didn't find that the case against Connor Grant had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt."
This story was repeated all day as other jurors were interviewed. At 3:45, Len Parisi gave a less-than-2-minute press conference on the steps of the hall.
"The verdict was decided by a jury of Mr. Grant's peers. He was found not guilty. I have to accept that. We all do. Thank you."
No questions at this time.
I got hold of Yuki, and she filled me in on the whole ghastly post-verdict eruption in courtroom 2A.
Not guilty on each of the 25 counts, she told me. Then this retired army guy got up and he was livid. Carrie Woodhouse. His wife Lisa had been killed in Citron, and he threatened to make Grant pay. That's a quote. I thought everyone in the gallery was going to cheer.